Emotions of beat, and that's the end. Now where you've been, you make the days roll on by. Blasting bombs out of the sky. Well, you know deep down that it's gonna be a hummer. Cause nobody's hotter than Atari this summer. Nobody's hotter than Atari this summer.
This summer, the really hot video games come from Atari. We've got Centipede, Ms. Pac-Man, Vanguard, and Galaxian. If you thought it was going to be just another summer, Atari is going to turn your head around.
The hot names, the hot games, the hot deals. Yeah, it's gonna be a hummer, cause nobody's hotter than Atari this summer. Nobody's hotter than Atari this summer.
Meow.
Hola.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's been a while. Seems like for me, I haven't podcasted in like 3 weeks.
It's geek dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Sound like you're cracking open a beer.
Root beer. It's close. Yeah, it has the word beer in it.
That's about as close as you get, right?
Mm-hmm. A&W 10. 10 tasting calories.
Oh. I like root beer.
We used to have a restaurant called Froggy Meisters, and they were like a restaurant that specialized in root beer. It was awesome. It had like 32 different flavors of root beer, and a couple of them were on tap. So it was nice. it was like a beer place, but it was root beer. It didn't make it, but it was a cool idea.
Yeah, sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me want some now. I just got some water here.
Ah. Do I sound okay? I don't sound muffled.
No,
when
do
I,
you have a...
When I did the my testing recording, it sounded really bad.
Do I sound okay?
Yeah, you sound good.
Excellente.
I just got a shipment today. So I now have a complete run of Future Comics.
Ah.
Yeah.
How many comics does that entail?
Not too many.
I didn't think they were around too long.
About 25, I think.
Okay.
It was a failed attempt, but an interesting attempt by David Michelinie and Bob Layton and Dick Giordano and a couple others, I think. This was like after Valiant, and they wanted to capture that kind of flavor of a comic, and they wanted to get away from Diamond. So they attempted to go directly to local comic shops, and it was a failed attempt. It didn't work very well. Comic shop people are kind of, like, owners are kind of lazy from what I gauge. Some of them are aggressive, but some of them, like, won't even take advantage of the returns, you know, when there are returns. Mm-hmm. And that's why when comics are returnable, it looks like they still sold a lot, but they're probably on shelf still. They don't return them.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear they can return them. They just have to rip off the front cover and then ship the box of covers, which is heartbreaking, but if you got to do it, you got to do it.
Yeah, isn't it? Nowadays, though, with the direct market, isn't it only certain ones that they can do that with?
It has to. If you ever look at the rankings of comics, you know, they'll have like the top 300, and then there'll be like only like a handful that have a little asterisk next to it, and that asterisk indicates returnable.
Yeah,
it's only a handful. It's usually for like number ones, or if they want to try to get retailers to buy more copies of something.
Right.
At a discounted price. Like that Valiant book. That's what I imagine Book of the not Book of the Geomancer, Death. What the hell is it called? Book of Death. It'll be returnable. But you have to order, like, I hated this thing. You had to order 25 copies of something to get one. It's not even a variant. It's an exclusive story. So it's expensive just to get a 22-page comic, you know? Because you have to pay for 25 of them. No, it's like...
That's kind of weird. I don't know if I like that.
Well, I hate it. I hate it. I am going to pay for it because I am all in, but I don't like it at all.
So you're going to have to get 25 copies of one comic?
I'm going to have to spend $20 on one comic. That's what I'm getting through DCBS, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But their comics are returnable. And they're supposed to have like this nice cover stock. And I can't imagine having to rip those covers off. That'd be heartbreaking if you're returning them.
Yeah, that's maybe the problem for some shops. You have some comic shops that are owned by people that are more fans than they are business people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, but...
And I got a shipment from mycomicshop.com, which had those future comics.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've read some of them, and they're really good. Like, I read the complete run of Death Mask, and I liked it. And then I got Future Mind and Metallics, and that's the whole run. There's not too many of them. And then I completed this weird series I didn't even know existed called Outcasts from DC. It's like a sci-fi thing by Wagner and Grant.
I've seen that covers of issues of that without really knowing anything about it. You know, you just happen to come across comic books in your travels that you recognize the name, but you don't know anything about it.
Yeah. And what else did I finish? I finished my zombie from Milestone, except I don't see it here. It's like it's missing. And what else? That's pretty much it. I got my last two Warlords because I miss a lot of annuals. Like, I had all the Catwomans, but I was missing annuals, and I was missing the Warlord annuals because I used to always think, well, they're not in continuity. I don't give a shit. I mean, they're not in the main story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like they'd have a theme every year, and if you didn't participate, you were okay. But some of them were great, like Armageddon. I really liked that. That was a good annual. And then they had the Elseworlds annuals, but I sat those out, so I don't have very many of those. And what else did I get? Oh, I got my two annuals from DC Comics Presents, so I have a full run of that, minus three issues. I'm missing the Crisis Superboy issue, a Legion of Superheroes issue, and a Wonder Woman issue. And then that's it. And then I got the full run of that.
That's very funny. So that means I have one of the issues
The Superboy one?
Yeah.
I have a Superboy one. I don't have the Crisis. Or no. I have the Crisis one. I don't have the first appearance of Superboy Prime.
Yeah. That's.
Is that it?
That is the Crisis one.
Okay.
I believe.
Yeah, that's the one I'm missing.
But I have nowhere
near. It's probably the most expensive one out of all of the DC Comics Presents. It's a harder book to find, that's for sure.
I think I just got lucky on that one. Found it cheap somewhere.
Yeah.
But I don't have I don't have that many issues of DC Comics Presents. It just happens that that's one of the ones I have. But it also happens that not that long ago I picked up those two annuals too, because I haven't read them yet, but they both seem like interesting stories, right? Because one's with Superwoman, and then the other one is with Earth 2 Superman, isn't it?
Shazam. Well, there's more than one. There's the Superwoman annual, and then there's, four of them.
Oh, four.
And you're okay. Probably talking about one or two, which I already had. But number three is the Superman and Shazam, and number four is the Superwoman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have the Superwoman one, and then I have one where he teams up with Earth 2 Superman. So both of those sounded interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't gotten too many back issues lately. I bought, because I went and bought, I had only pre-ordered a handful of Convergence miniseries. And then when I got done reading the ones that I got in my shipment, I wanted to read more. So I ended up...
I'm glad you're enjoying them, because a lot of people don't seem to. They really clicked with me. Like... Really clicked with me, especially the week that had the pre-crisis. Oh man, yeah. I was like in heaven with all of those. I was like, give me more. Where's the next one?
Yeah, and a lot of the ones that I had pre-ordered were from that week, There's pre-Flashpoint. Then there's ones that are around 0 hour.
Yeah, pre-zero hour and pre-crisis, and that's it. Those are the three time
periods. Yeah. So a lot of the ones that I ordered were from the later weeks, weeks 3 and 4, if you want to look at it that way, or the pre-zero hour, pre-crisis. But and a lot of those are really good. But even the other ones... Now, the main series, I've read the first four.
Yeah.
And it's not bad, but it's just kind of middle of the road for me.
It is a very strange story because it introduced the main character, and then it kind of took off where Earth 2 left off.
Yeah.
So wherever Earth 2 ended... That's where this story began. And then they decided to throw a curveball and then focus a lot of it on Skataris, which is the warlord, and Deimos, and, you know, the whole crew there.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they did a lot of stuff. And issue 5, it kind of flipped things around a little bit. So it felt more like a mainstream event, whereas the other four were kind of like leading up to it in a very, very, very weird way. I enjoyed it because I love Earth 2 characters, mm-hmm. and I love the Warlord. You know, I'm a huge mm-hmm. Mike Grell fan, so it's like, I was digging it, even though it wasn't Mike Grell. This is the Warlord. If it's the only way I can get it, I'll take it any way I can get it.
Yeah.
I can see why people don't like it, though.
Yeah. And I think what I was expecting was more what happens to be in the miniseries, which is fine. It's definitely hasn't, the main series definitely hasn't been what I expected, but that's okay. It hasn't been bad, but like you said, it was just kind of a surprise that it was mostly focusing on the Earth 2 characters, but the mini series, I just like the way that it, in a lot of ways, is you're getting to see so many different eras of DC, so many different characters from so many different eras at the same time.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I just like the way that it makes me think about DC's history and the different characters. And
that's because you get it, my friend. You get it. You have an appreciation. I think I understand how a new person could hate this. because they just throw you into a story. See, I've read Flashpoint. I've read Zero Hour. I've read Crisis. So I, like, know all those time periods. Of course, the farther away you go, I have to remember a lot more, you know? Like, Flashpoint was fresh in my head. Zero Hour, pretty fresh in my head. Also, because I've been hearing, you know, comics and history talk a lot about Zero Hour. So, it was, you know, that helped. You know, so I remembered what happened and how it worked and what the main gist of it was. And then Crisis, I knew everything that happened, but I don't remember the side stories that tied into it. So I, like, knew the time period. I knew the main event, but then I had to remember certain things. Like, certain things fit pretty good, like Blue Beetle, where it was like, oh, we haven't even started writing this character yet in pre-Crisis, so we're going to do the Charlton era Blue Beetle with, you know, Captain Atom and the Question.
Yeah.
But, I love it. I think if they put the front, you know how they had the two pages in the back? I think if they put that in the front and set the stage for the people that didn't know that stuff, it would have helped, because it would have said, you know, this is what happened prior, and here's where we're kind of taking off. And this is not your new 52 Nightwing. This is this Nightwing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Where it could be jarring for somebody that's in and out of DC.
Yeah, even if it was just, even if they had that in the back, but they had some kind of a first page or something. You know, I don't know. DC just doesn't seem to like to do that the way that Marvel does. The sort of, to put that first page, it gives you a recap or some kind of way of getting into the story. It helps me remember.
I like it. It's very different from old comics, because old comics would start off and then it would recap within a couple panels like what might have happened prior.
Yeah.
Well, the new comics, they don't do that. They just go forward. And then some comics are more memorable than others. Like, you remember all the beats of it just because it's a really good comic or a lot of event. But the ones that are kind of just average, I like to have that front material just to refresh where I left off, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's a month later and you've read, you know, 50 more comics or 100 more comics, and yeah, you know, it's kind of what happened.
Yeah, it helps. It helps, especially if you go longer than that. I guess it works out good for me, because I will sometimes go quite a while without reading any Marvel. And I'll definitely need those recap pages.
Do they have those in the Marvel app?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they usually have the creator credits on that page too.
Yeah.
But actually, one of the issues I read tonight has a really good example of a recap within the story itself, though.
Well, do you want to jump into it then?
Sure, I could. It's a good segue. Yeah, I guess we could say that we're no Buck Rogers this evening.
Yeah, this is a different recording. We usually record on Sunday mornings.
Yep.
And lately I've had family in town or a convention, and I'm going to another convention this weekend. So it's that time of year where you got vacations, families, and stuff, and I've been missing a lot of podcasts. But you know what? It's kind of a good break every now and then.
Yeah.
To recharge your engines. So yeah, we're recording on a work night, which is really weird, especially for me, because I'm usually at work at this time, but I left early. And I'm taking Friday off because of Denver Comic Con. So yeah, we're recording on a night. I couldn't watch Buck Rogers. You probably watched it, right?
No, I hadn't by the time we decided we weren't going to, so I just waited.
Well, that's good, because then it'll be fresh in your mind instead of...
That's what I figured, yeah.
Yeah.
And so if you hadn't already guessed from the fact that I said it was Geek Brunch Dinner and... or Geek Dinner. And this evening and whatnot. But... All right, so tonight, though I won't be able to stay awake and see it, tonight is apparently the last David Letterman.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that, and I remembered that there was an issue of the Avengers where they went on the David Letterman show. So I pulled that up on the Marvel Unlimited app, and decided to read that, thought that it would fit. And that's actually Avengers issue 239. It's Marvel had this thing back then where they would do assistant editors month, where the assistant editor would be in charge of the book, and they would use it as an excuse to sometimes do some wacky stuff. And in this case, we have the Avengers appearing on the David Letterman show. And the David Letterman show, at the point that this issue came out, had been around for a couple years. Definitely back from what I'm told.
After Johnny Carson. It was on a different station, too. NBC.
Yeah. And he was on the NBC till the 90s, but back in the day, especially in the early years that he was on TV, it was definitely a really hip show, it was a cool thing to be in a David Letterman, at least that's what I read, because I was only a little kid at the time. But when this comic originally came out, I don't think I could even really read that well yet. But so the cover is the Avengers on Late Night with David Letterman. It's got David Letterman with Wonder Man, Hawkeye, Black Widow, Black Panther, and the Beast is hanging up from the top of the cover. And David Letterman saying, "And we're going to have more fun than Earth's Mightiest Heroes should be allowed to have." The story is called Late Night of the Superstars. And it actually starts out with Hawkeye returning to Avengers Mansion with Mockingbird. And when they come through the door, well, they're wondering where everybody's at, and Jarvis is nowhere to be seen. Then all of a sudden, the Vision's head appears in the air above them, in front of them, and speaks to them. And then he eventually explains, and this is where I was talking about how there's a whole bunch of filling you in on what's going on, because on page 3, the really dense page with a lot of panels and a lot of word bubbles and captions where Vision fills you in on what's been going on with the Avengers by way of explaining why disembodied head is talking to them and not his body, because his body is in a reconstructive chamber, this kind of medical chamber, because in issue 233, the Avengers had fought Annihilus, and normally the repair systems in his body would have restored him in a matter of hours, but this time, even after a couple days, it hadn't. So Star Fox, who recently joined the team, set something up with him in a direct link between the world computer on Titan, where Star Fox has come, to try to diagnose his condition. But that's what's given him the ability to still communicate outside of his body in the way that he's doing with them. And so then Hawkeye fills him in with what he's been up to, and this was kind of neat because it contextualized for me where we're at with Hawkeye and his whole journey, because he's been on a lot of different teams and done a lot of different stuff, and apparently this is taking place right after the Hawkeye Limited series that they had, and him and Mockingbird have just gotten married. So once that's all squared away, the Avengers Mansion gets a call from Wonder Man, you know, and his whole deal, he's in Hollywood and all that. So it's through him that the invitation to appear on the Letterman show came, and they wanted to bring some other Avengers with them. And a lot of the Avengers that are on the team right now are busy. So Vision starts putting out the call to different other reserve Avengers and stuff, and he reaches Black Panther. He's in the middle of a meeting with Wakandan advisors, and Beast, at first he's reluctant to help out with Avengers stuff because he says he's got his own group that he's got to pay attention to, and later he says something more about that, so to clarify that it's the Defenders that he's talking about have recently started up. But when he finds out it's going to be the Letterman show, he's like, oh, okay. He gets a hold of Black Widow, who's sunbathing on a rooftop somewhere.
Why?
So then... huh?
Why did he get a hold of Black Widow, who's sunbathing on a rooftop somewhere?
Are you feeling angry at Black Widow?
No, I'm just... why did he call her all of a sudden to come to the show?
Well... yeah, Vision put the call out to
Okay.
as many possible Avengers just to try to gather up a group to go on the Letterman show.
And she just happened to be sunbathing.
Yeah. Just happens to be at that time.
This is an area where the Defenders were really weird. It was like the X-Men. It was like Iceman, Angel, Beast, Gargoyle, Valkyrie, and a couple others. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was basically the X-Men that, or the original X-Men that they didn't want to use in the X-Men comic anymore. Like, they had Scott and Jean, but the other three, they didn't really want to be worried about them. So that's all well and good. But this is a comic book, so they need some kind of antagonist for this story, not just having them go on the Letterman show. And so this is where they bring in Fabian Stankiewicz. And he had appeared a couple times before this, and actually appears quite a few times, especially in Captain America, but I didn't recognize him from just his name here, but he sees that the Avengers are going to be on Letterman, so he's excited to see that, because he's going to go and he's going to try to prove that he's a real deal Superman or supervillain.
What is he? What is his villain name?
His, you know, and the funny thing, I don't think they even mention it in here, because he uses a bunch of technology, but isn't actually I'll get it for you again in a minute, but
Stankiewicz.
Yeah, Stankiewicz.
Stankiewicz.
The Stankmeister.
He's got that power to like sneak up the room.
Yeah. No, that's Keith Knutson.
Yeah. Brown Arrow.
So in New York City at Rockefeller Plaza, the Avengers are all gathering backstage in the green room and stuff. And Stankiewicz is there in disguise, pretending to be a repairman, just because he's setting up a lot of stuff to happen during the show later on. And there's a little bit of kind of a funny scene where Hawkeye and Black Widow haven't seen each other for a while. Oh, and the one thing I forgot to mention was that's kind of funny is that as a result of the adventure that Hawkeye had in the limited series, he was up against Crossfire and he had to use this hypersonic arrowhead in his mouth to disrupt this ultrasonic device that Crossfire had, so it worked and they escaped, but it totally blew out his hearing.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, so this is that time period, and
he's done that a couple times. even in the modern Hawkeye, he can't hear with the dam.
Yeah. So I think this is kind of the start of that happening, or that characteristic of his. So that's a bit of a plot point there. So Frank Stankiewicz, I got it here. He's appeared as a couple different things. He was the Mecho Marauder or Mechano Marauder, and then the Mechanaut later on. He first appeared in Avengers 217 and then 221, and then this is his fourth appearance because he was in a Marvel 2-in-1 also.
They better seek that out because he's going to be in the next Avengers movie. I'm calling it right now. First appearance is going to sell for like $100.
There
it's
going to
be in the next Avengers movie. You heard it right here on Geek Brunch Retrocast.
All that business about Thanos and stuff is just just a trick.
It's really this guy, Stankiewicz.
So you have Black Widow and Hawkeye, and Hawkeye is introducing his new wife to Black Widow. Kind of awkwardly says, "Oh, Tasha, I don't think you've met the Mockingbird. She and I, that is, you see, we're..." And finally she finishes the sentence for him. "Married is the word he's searching for." And Black Widow congratulates Mockingbird, says that she must be a brave woman for marrying Hawkeye. So Hawkeye is the only one that's actually a full-fledged Avenger at the time. So even though Wonder Man was the one that was initiated all this one, he feels like he should be the spokesperson as the only active Avenger. So he has a list, because he can't hear very well, he has a list of the questions that Letterman is going to ask in his hand, and he's looking over them. So it's showtime. David Letterman does his little bit and introduces his band leader, and Paul Schaefer is in there too, and he's got a Captain America t-shirt on. And so they bring out the Avengers, and there's a whole bunch of chairs, and they're all sitting there. And this is actually on live television where Beast drops the bomb that he's going to be quitting the Avengers because he's formed the Defenders. So because of that, surprise, Letterman asks, "Wow, that was some bombshell the Beast just dropped. Hawkeye, you're a group spokesman. What do you think of that?" And Hawkeye can't hear what he's saying for a damn, so he just answers what he thinks the first question was supposed to be. He says, "Well, David, the Avengers is a non-profit organization fully sanctioned as a peacekeeping force by just about every international organization you could think of." And
that's funny.
So Letterman's trying to play it off. He said, "You know, I was just going to ask you something along those lines. You wouldn't be psychic by any chance." And Hawkeye says, "No, of the founding members, only the Wasp and Thor remain as active Avengers."
You can't hear shit.
No. So Letterman figures out what's going on. He says, "Hey, you've been peeking at my question sheet, haven't you? All right, well, I might as well ask you the next question." And so then it lines up where they're supposed to be. So I thought that was actually a pretty funny little gag.
That sucks. I can relate to that.
Exactly. Yeah, he has the ringing.
Well, he has the ringing and he can't hear for shit. There was one of the maintenance guys the other day who was telling me about his teeth. So he said, I saw the dentist or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I heard that he had kids. And he had to drop them off or something like that. And I was like, well, how old are your kids? And he goes, I don't have any kids. What are you talking about? It's because I can't hear what the fuck.
Oh, so you misheard what somebody said.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's a quiet talker.
Yeah. So
I have a hard time hearing him. And not only that, but when you enter my cube, you enter my cube on my bad ear. Mm. So it's like I can't hear it. I have like a dead spot.
Yeah.
So I can relate to what Hawkeye is saying. I mean, going through. Yeah. Because sometimes I can't hear it. Hear what anybody's saying.
Yeah.
At least Letterman I have one good ear.
Right. Yeah. Letterman's in his dead zone.
Yeah.
So it's this point is when Stankiewicz brings his Stankiewicz, and he triggers a bunch of machinery to start coming out and attacking the team. And the band keeps playing. They show Paul Schaefer's thinking, if we stop playing, then they're going to know, the audience is going to know that this isn't part of the act, so we better keep playing through this so that the audience doesn't panic. But that's making Stankiewicz, who's got a disguise on in the crowd, even more angry that the crowd isn't taking it seriously. But the Avengers are, and they're basically fighting a bunch of technology. And then Stankiewicz gets up, and because everyone's pretty occupied, all the Avengers, he goes up and he sits down in the chair next to Letterman. And he said, "Good evening, Dave. You don't have to worry anymore. It's safe here." And I said, that's reassuring. Who might you be? He says, "I'm Fabian Stankiewicz. I created the machines that have the Avengers helpless." "Is that so?" And then Letterman's thinking to himself, "I better keep this crazy guy's attention until they get the security team out here." And so he gets Stankiewicz to sit there and explain to all of his machines and stuff like that. And it gets to the point where Hawkeye figures out what's going on, so he tries to shoot this kind of specialized arrow in the direction of Stankiewicz, but Stankiewicz has a force field around him and David Letterman, so they're protected and stuff like that. But at that point, Letterman pulls this huge, gigantic prop doorknob out from behind his desk and smacks Stankiewicz on the top of the head with it and knocks him out and takes the device that he used to control all the machines away from him. And that's kind of the end of the thing. The Stankiewicz tries to get away, but he runs into Mockingbird, who knocks him out. And that night, it resolves with Hawkeye takes the Avengers ID card from Beast, saying that, you know, it's not right for him to be an Avengers reservist, since he's going to be focused on making the Defenders a real supergroup. And then the last part is Wonder Man pacing around, excited and nervous about seeing their appearance on television. And it gets interrupted by an ABC or NBC News special bulletin. But that was by Roger Stern, with art by Al Milgrom and Joe Sinnott. And it was a fun, kind of amusing story.
Who's the assistant editor? Is that Roger Stern?
No.
Writing it?
Roger Stern wrote it, but the assistant editor.
Oh, they're just editing it. They're not the driving force of the creative team.
Right. Yeah. They just.
They just let the editor take a vacation, and now it's assistant editor's month.
Yeah,
he could do with whatever he wants.
It was mostly a gimmick. I've seen ones that are a lot crazier than this one. The main thing that was different about this one is, you know, they happened to go on the Letterman show. The assistant editor was Michael Carlin.
Ah, he's a big time editor. He was the DC guy.
Yeah,
till he retired.
The regular editor at the time was Gruenwald, Mark Gruenwald.
Fantastic guy. Golly. I loved his cap. I am not too much of a Marvel guy. I enjoy Marvel just as well as anything, but you know, but Gruenwald, when he was writing Cap, man, I had to get every issue. Mm-hmm. And then when he did the Squadron Supreme, oh man, I just loved his work. He was one of those guys that could keep a monthly in such a state like a soap opera that you had to get the next issue. Yeah. Like there was so many intertwining plot lines and Serpent Society and all this crap going on, and you didn't want to miss an issue because there was so much going on.
Yeah, that's one of the things about that style of writing where they didn't write for the trade, that there was never a real break where you thought, okay, the story's over, and you don't, it might have resolved the main plot, but you saw enough of what was coming up because they teased the next storyline that you're already interested in that, so you want to keep getting it, you know?
Yeah, what a great guy died. That sucks.
Yeah, too early.
Yeah. Fantastic editor, fantastic writer. Mike Carlin's a great one too. I mean, there's some great editors in our scheme of things as we talk editors. But some of them back then really drove the bus, man.
Mm-hmm.
They like knew what a title should be, and then they let the creators do as long as they stayed within the confines. There's not editors like that today. I think editors today are more pushovers because the creators have become so popular. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They could almost get away with doing what they want to do.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. I think the editors are, you know, both companies have laid off a lot of editors, so the editors nowadays probably have a heavier workload.
Yeah. They're a little more lenient, too, I think.
Yeah,
whereas
probably
back in the day, they'd be like, get the fuck out of my office with this shit. You didn't get this right. Like, there's certain things in Convergence that are not editorially very good. Some of the rules about the dome
mm-hmm.
are not consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the artist will do something like Legion of Superheroes. So they explain Colossus Boy, you know, why he's big. Because during this time, his power was to shrink. He was normally big.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the original origin, they switched his origin around a lot. But So they explained why he was big. But in one panel, they have Sun Boy just like with extreme power, you know, coming out of his hand, you know, like solar power coming out. And I'm like, how does he have it? The dome's up. And then the other complaint they had was, well, they were all flying, but they explained that. They didn't explain it in all the issues that Legion showed up, but they explained it in one of them that said that Brainiac, you know, 5 had done something with the rings to keep them operational. In other words, when the dome came over, the rings failed, and then Brainiac worked on them because the whole thing about the dome is you could still make technology, but you got to make it work after the dome comes up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It'll render your technology inoperable initially. So, yeah. But the latest one was in the main title. They showed a group of Red Lanterns and Charles Soule had killed all those guys off.
No.
And I'm like, God, I miss those guys, but I know they're dead.
Was it vague enough that they could have been taken before they died or something? Or
no.
No, okay.
A matter of fact, Dan DiDio answered. I don't ever, like, tag him or anything, but I know mm-hmm. He reads my posts sometimes. And this time I just said, man, Convergence was a great read, but I had a little bit of an issue seeing some of my favorite Red Lanterns, because I really grew to love some of these Red Lanterns. You know, when Charles mm-hmm. Soule was writing them, he like gave them character, he gave them heart and characterization that, man, I just like fell in love with these guys, and then they died, and I'm like, oh shit. they took all my favorite ones and killed them, and they showed up in a panel. But yeah, there's editor mistakes.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I think there's like an editor looks at it and maybe they might catch it and they're like, do I really want to send these back to the artist to draw, or will it go past 90% of the people that are reading it?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I bet those decisions happen.
Yeah.
Where back in the day, I don't think they happened too much.
Yeah, either that,
or you know, some of the writers got to do whatever they wanted to, like in Brave and the Bold, and mm-hmm. they even had like their own Earth. Oh, this is happening on Earth B or whatever the hell it was called, because of Crazy Haney or whatever his name was, Bob Haney.
Bob Haney.
They let him do whatever he wanted. But my title that I read came out of Convergence because I didn't know it existed until I read Convergence number 0. And Convergence number 0 was kind of interesting in the back matter because they kind of said, well, we're going to have a lot of these different cities. And here's where those cities came from. And here's their first appearances of the cities. Instead of here's the first appearance of a character, yeah. Here's the first appearance of this metropolis. Here's this first appearance of, I can't remember what they called this, El Nefino or whatever. But this was the Western Elseworlds title that played a big part in the Nightwing. And then in a couple other titles, it was destroyed in Convergence. But this is Justice Writers, and it's an Elseworlds one-shot graphic novel. It's one of those thick deluxe format, like Batman Returns, mm-hmm. Or you know, that kind of format. And it's by Chuck Dixon and J.H. Williams III. And we all know J.H. Williams did a lot with panel layouts in the current titles. Mm-hmm. And you could kind of see him going against the grain in here because there's like circular stuff and there's panels within panels. And so, you know, this was in 1997. He was still doing that kind of thing. And it's a really cool Western tale, and you might want to get it because it has your favorite character, Wally West, in it. He's the Flash.
Nice.
And it's so funny when he gets in a gunfight. He's like, he doesn't like run to take anybody out, but he's like shooting the pistols like really fast. He's like a machine gun, like a Gatling gun, because he can pull the trigger so fast and reload. But Wonder Woman's the sheriff, and she's actually bringing two fugitives in to a prison, and she's protecting this town called Paradise. And Diana brings them in. She has them handcuffed to horses, brings them in, and finds out her whole town was destroyed. And everybody's dead. But she does manage to get to her deputy. And you know who her deputy is? Mr. Miracle Oberon. So Oberon was her deputy. And so she is really hurt that she lost her town and she lost her best friend, who was Oberon. And she goes to recruit a bunch of guys to go after the main villain, who's Maxwell Lord. And I can't remember what year Wonder Woman broke Maxwell Lord's neck, but I think this is prior to that.
Yeah, that
that was in the 2000s for sure, right?
This for
is
sure.
This is 1997. So Maxwell Lord is the bad guy in this, which is really cool because he's a awful person. Like, he has like all these like robots, which they're not OMAX, but they're kind of like robots. Mm-hmm. And he's working with Felix Faust, and he has his own town that actually destroyed Wonder Woman's town. So Wonder Woman teams up with Hawkman, who's a Native American, who's had the Nth Metal, and he can fly. Wally West, who has Guy Gardner after him, because Guy Gardner works for, God, what was those? I want to say the Penningtons, or I can't remember what it is. It's in Young Guns. But he works for that big exchange. They're, in historical exchange, they're a rich faction in the Wild West. And Guy Gardner is going after Wally West because he supposedly murdered Barry Allen. So he's got a warrant to go bring him in alive or dead. And they never explain, although Wally does try to stop him from getting killed. He's like, you know, I didn't do it or whatever, but they don't really get into it. It's like a plot line they never resolve. Mm-hmm. So they also get old Blue Beetle and Booster Gold, which is awesome.
Oh, that's cool.
And Blue Beetle is a techno guy. Like, he's like brilliant. He can make all these like steampunk things and all these engines, and the Booster's kind of like a gun happy dude who carries around a Gatling gun. It's like but it is a really cool story, and their whole job is to go back after Maxwell Lord, and it kind of has a climactic battle at the end. And Felix Faust escapes. And Maxwell Lord, Martian Manhunter is also in this. And they find out that a Daemonite, you know, the aliens with the red circles on their forehead, was actually helping Maxwell Lord make all this technology to, you know, all the robots and everything.
Okay.
So they basically stopped Maxwell Lord. He had this killer, like, steam engine train, like something out of Mad Max. That he came after him with, but it was so much fun. I'd highly recommend it. It's a good book. If you're a Wally West fan or a Wonder Woman fan or a Blue Beetle or Booster, just to see them in these, in a Western setting is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Just the idea. It's a cool idea. I was like you with Convergence Zero. That was one of the ones I hadn't heard before, and I didn't jump on it as quickly as you did, but I was already thinking, even before we talked about it, that it would be a cool thing to pick up sometime. So now that you said that you liked it too, even more so.
Yeah, especially because of the Wally connection. I thought you like to have a lot of his appearances, and this is like an Elseworlds with them, so.
Yeah, I have. I have most of them, so. That's cool. But yeah, I didn't even, before Convergence Zero, I didn't even know that that existed.
Yeah, I didn't either. And I know a lot of a lot of comics, but I'm not good at Elseworlds stuff, because I ignored it. I was like, that don't matter. It's over there. But as I'm enjoying the Elseworlds a lot more now.
Mm-hmm.
Than I would have then.
Yeah, it seems your attitude now seems more like you're pretty open to different interpretations of characters and stuff.
Yeah.
Not just the the main current continuity.
Yeah, I'm not as big as continuity used to really drive me insane when they'd break the rules.
Mm-hmm.
But now it doesn't.
Yeah.
Now I just take it with a grain of salt. I note it. I was like, that's weird.
Yeah.
Sometimes it drives me crazy, though. They're, like, I was reading a Dead Drop, which is a new Valiant book.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice Cott wrote XO so weird. Like, his voice didn't even sound like Eric. And then he didn't even understand, like, his armor. Or if his armor wasn't working, he didn't explain it. They kind of like dropped him out of the sky like the Hulk, and he never flew. He's in this armor running after somebody the whole time. Like, you can imagine this armor just going ching 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 running down. Come on, man, fire those thrusters! And I was like, man, I really would love to have seen the script to see if it was his fault or if it was the artist, because the artist, I've never seen any of his work before. And if somebody wrote a scene and said, well, Arik is chasing this woman through the streets, and the guy didn't know that Arik had, he knew he had armor because he drew him, right? But maybe he didn't know he could fly. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that seems pretty running. Strange,
it's
though.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
But it was a damn good story, but things like that, sometimes, depending on how bad they are, they can take you out of the story. So you don't enjoy it, even though it's a good story. It's a good story to enjoy.
Yeah, I don't mind small continuity things, but the bigger stuff, they should take care of that.
Yeah, when the voice isn't right either, like the way somebody talks, it's just weird.
Yeah.
I can get past most of it, but sometimes there's incidents like that that it takes me a little bit out. But we've talked a lot about editors today.
That's strange. I only think about editors in the evening, that's why.
It's so such a thankless job. It's one of those things like you don't notice them or you don't praise them until they make a mistake. Then but there's been some good editors, especially like, I don't know if you were reading Batman Eternal, but man, that book was tight.
And yeah.
They had a lot of art teams, and the writers rotated between four writers and they had two plotters. So that's a lot of juggling to try to keep a book seamless. And that book really did seem like one continuous story. You know, it was really well done.
Yeah, I did. I did read the whole thing. I finished that shit before you did.
Yeah, you did.
it was very impressive. They must have done a lot of work on plotting that too. They must have had a lot of notes. That's my suspicion, at least.
Really well done though, for 52 weeks on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. Man.
Yep. Yeah, it was tight. That was really good. Well, speaking of an editor that a lot of comic book fans do know of, my next book was edited by Julius Schwartz.
Ah!
And he was definitely an editor that ruled the roost. what he said went, I believe. But that was definitely a...
He also seemed like he was very loved, though.
Yeah, he does.
Harley's going, if you could hear like a caller going around, she's going ballistic playing with her toys. She's running around the house squeaking toys.
Is that one of her new ones from the Bark Box?
Yeah, from the Bark Box.
Nice.
And then she grabs Woody Woodpecker and it laughs. I don't know if you could hear it, but... goes, da da ha ha ha. She's running around with that thing in her mouth.
That's funny.
So which Julie Schwartz book do we have?
This is Superman 415. And this is a Crisis crossover. I actually talked about 414 on the show at one point, I believe. This I got for $1 on Comixology today, well, or yesterday, because they're having these convergence sales, and where they're doing dollar comics that relate to convergence stories that week. And so this is a story called Supergirl, Bride of X? And it was written by Carrie Bates.
Ah, my favorite.
With pencils by Kurt Swan and inks by Al Williamson. So this is an interesting story because it takes place... Well, the cover gives you an idea of what's going to be going on because it says, revealed at last, Supergirl's secret marriage. So it takes place actually after Crisis... on Infinite Earths,
so number she's 7. Dead? She's dead?
Yeah, so it takes place, she's dead. Superman, when in the beginning, he's helping out this aquatic drilling operation or something like that. But then he just takes off. Like, well, I guess he must have been called to an emergency or something because he leaves without saying anything. And it's because his ears picked up this hypersonic code that told him that someone has entered his fortress of solitude. And so he gets there and he goes into the room that was Supergirl's, and there's this strange guy. He's got light green skin, dark green hair, and he's wearing a purple and yellow outfit, and Superman stops him just as he's about to pick up this object that's a small green sphere about the size of the palm of your hand with these yellow sticks coming out of it. And this guy says that this object belongs to him, and But then he's surprised to see Superman's costume and says, the style of your garb, your colors are strikingly similar to hers. But he says something about somebody called Jasma, and then he dematerializes, taking the object with him. But, you know, Superman, he's able to pick up with his super hearing, he's able to pick up the sound of the guy's heartbeat, and he starts to pursue him. The other guy can fly as well, and it's not long before he catches up, so the guy tries to put these energy barriers up in front of him. They're golden in color, and they look like huge slices of bread or something. Not really, but they're square-shaped, I guess. Anyway, Superman flies through several of them pretty easily. Well, it turns out the last one was purposely made a lot stronger than the first few, so that he's going at pretty high velocity, and he gets briefly stuck on this last one, but is able to use his heat vision to cause it to explode and catches up with the guy. And briefly knocks the guy out and gets the device back from him. And Superman's looking at the device. He doesn't really know what it is. He just knows that he had seen Kara with it quite often in the past few months before she died. We never really got a chance to ask what it was. And unfortunately, the guy that this alien dude happens to have some telekinetic powers. So when he comes to, before he gets up, he grabs a hold of Superman's mind. And as a result, the two of them end up sharing memories. So this is where we get filled in to what happened, that a couple years ago, Supergirl was adrift in space. She was knocked out, and this alien, he came. He saw her floating in space, and his spaceship, he picked her up and did some tests on her. And when she woke up, she didn't remember who she was. She had amnesia, so he introduces himself as Salcor, and they're on his planet, Macor. So she doesn't know who she is or what her name is, so he gives her the name Jasmah, which is the name of a beautiful flower on their world, and he helps her recuperate, and the two of them end up becoming a team, protecting their city and stuff, and people get used to seeing the two of them together, and they fall in love and end up getting married. And to symbolize their love, he gives her what at this point we now recognize as that green sphere, and he calls it a hoku, HOKKU. And what it does, it's kind of like that, it's kind of like one of those memory globe devices. I guess it's different. I was initially thinking of after Jean Grey died, and they had that globe with sort of her essence in it that they gave to her parents. But anyway, this is sort of different, but similar. It records all her thoughts. So then this villain called Nax, he's an intergalactic mercenary and goes to attacks their planet to, he's been hired to wipe out the race of these people. It's this green mechanical one person spaceship kind of thing, and it's got this also green alien with four limbs piloting it. So the alien, Supergirl, and what's his face, her alien husband Salcor. Supergirl and Salcor, they fight off this alien, and it crashes, and and blows up the green spaceship, and there's no sign of the alien that was piloting it. But in the course of the fight, Supergirl is kind of broken up by things, or she's a little bit injured and stuff, and she's feeling kind of faint. So she thinks, you know, I should just lay down and get some rest. So the next morning, Salcor wakes up and she's gone. There's no message, no clue or anything where she had gone. The only thing he knows is that he took the Hoku with her. And that's the only way he was able to track her down, because it had sort of a homing signal connected to it. So it took a long time, and the signal was really weak at first, but he kept searching and searching until he tracked her down. So at this point, well, so then when as he got closer and closer to Earth, he started picking up television broadcasts and learning English, and found out that, you know, the woman that he had known as Jasmine was Supergirl, but he also found out that she had been killed. That's why he came for the Hoku, because it was the only piece of her that, you know, he could get now that she was gone. So now that this has all been explained and everything, the hack, the Nax, shows up, but it turns out that the alien that was piloting it wasn't the Nax. That was just an alien that it was using. The Nax is actually was actually the ship itself, the green ship, and it's reformed itself into more of a anthropomorphic robot-like being, and it's able to just break its way right into the Fortress of Solitude. So Superman has to team up with the with Selcor to fight Nax, and it's pretty formidable. They have a bit of a problem with it because in reforming itself, it also when it reforms itself, it makes sure that it has the power to, or that it combats, has a way to combat powers that have defeated it in the past. And Supergirl's powers are pretty similar to Superman, so he's kind of set for Superman. But the way they come up to defeat him is they, Selcor and Superman, combine their powers in a way that Selcor and Supergirl had never done before. They, he fuses his force, a force wedge, with Superman's vulnerability, and that is able to do it. And so Superman throws the different pieces of the Nax into outer space, but on different trajectories across the cosmos. And the epilogue is the two of them. It turns out that Supergirl recorded a message into the Haku for them, because I think this is one of the things that was in, I can't remember if it was in the last issue of Superman or if it was, I think it was the DC Comics Presents crossover or tie-in that had Supergirl in it, but I know that Supergirl was having visions of her death prior to dying, and so that's one of the ways she recorded this to say goodbye. She says, "Farewell, Selcor," and then there's a bunch of scribbly marks, Kal-El, that's supposed to indicate Kryptonian, I guess. That she says goodbye in Kryptonian. So, and then Selcor takes his leave. So it's a very, sort of, I don't know, it was strange. It's kind of, it was an interesting story in that they put in this marriage that Supergirl had, that Superman never knew about it, and when she remembered who she was, she just kind of took off and left. So it's not definitely not a Crisis tie-in. That's a strong tie-in to Crisis. It more has to do with Supergirl, and the only really tie-in is that it takes place after she's dead, but before Crisis ends and continuity changes and stuff. Did I put you to sleep?
Are you there?
Yeah.
I was talking to mute.
Oh.
I was,
that's
like,
that's my move. Your co-hosts are supposed to do that. Me and Bill. That's our.
Well, that's, I was our supposed. Job. I've been like opening the door because Harley's driving me nuts. She's.
Yeah.
And I went mute, but man, I forgot what I was going to ask. Now I got. So she did this before she died, and now she's dead. So she did this marriage and then left that guy.
Yeah, because she remembered who she was and came back to Earth.
Yeah. I've seen her in a couple of covers, like in Adventure Comics, getting married to aliens and stuff. I don't know. I don't know if it was like a big Supergirl thing back then. I don't know. Let's marry her off.
Yeah, and I wonder.
There's one where he's like, the guy she's marrying is dragging her down the... She's like on the floor unconscious, and he's just dragging her by her cape.
Jeez.
Down the aisle.
I wonder at this point the Julia Schwartz just said, yeah, do whatever. That's fine. Doesn't matter. You know, she's dead, but on top of it, she's going to be wiped out of continuity for soon. So just, yeah, if you want to have a story where she happens to have been married to an alien.
Then she doesn't come back until Matrix, right? Where she's part machine and working for Luthor. And then the Peter David Supergirl comes.
Yeah, different.
Yeah, different. Where she's an angel.
So, are you an angel?
Yeah. So my next book is the first appearance of a major character that I never read before, but it's the Omega Men number 3. And the Omega Men is being relaunched by Tom King on the New 52, or whatever they call it now, DC's new line. They don't call it 52 anymore.
No.
But this is the first appearance of Lobo. And it's an interesting – I've read the first two issues, and it's a pretty cool series. A lot of the characters I'm just getting to know, so I don't, like, know them by name yet. So this one is called Assault on Euphorics, and it's an interesting one – the main aliens that these guys fight is the Citadel, and you could think of them as kind of like the Empire. They just want to go from planet to planet and enforce their rule and destroy each planet. And this one planet is shielded by technology, and they can't break the barrier, or so we think. But they do manage to explode the barrier and get in. Well, an alarm goes out to the Omega Men, who is kind of like the Rebel Alliance. And Primus's wife, Callista, gets the message and decides she needs to go there as soon as possible to try to help the people on this planet, Euphorics. And before that message comes in, there's this weird scene here where one of Tigor's trusted allies. It seems like you have the Rebel Alliance, and there's two parties that are fighting for leadership, and they each have followers. So Tigor has his followers, and Primus has his followers. Primus is the guy with long hair. Tigor is probably the most noticeable Omega Man. He's kind of like a tiger-looking guy. So when you say Omega Man, if anybody remembers any of them, you know, Tigor is probably the guy that you'll remember. But there's this weird sexual scene in here where this guy is is like, he's like a demon looking guy, and I guess he's in the Tigor camp, and he's watching this snake lady dance naked in front of him, and he like wants to have sex with this girl so bad. And then it cuts to a scene where Callista gets the message. And she just happens to be naked, running to the – but she's with no one because her husband is out on a mission with Tigor. And Callista gathers some of her members to go with her. One of them looks like it's Harpy. I think her name is Harpy, and grabs another person, and they take off in a ship. And they kind of like use warp drive. So they take off, boom, they end up in an asteroid field, and it destroys part of their wing, and then they're incapacitated, and they're trying to survive on this ship that's pretty much been destroyed. But this weird-looking brain-look alien goes on there, and it was actually sent there for a reason. But Primus and Tigor on another planet on called Slag, and they're having a quarrel about who's going to lead them into the future. And then they just throw Lobo in here. Well, first they introduce this character. I can't remember his name, but it's like Hempback or Humpback. And he actually looks like Fred Hempback. Do you remember the cartoonist that draws those little – you know how he used to draw himself?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if Keith Giffen threw this in there as like a jab at him, or as one of his best friends and threw him in as a character. But he's actually like an alien, and it actually looks like that guy in the strips that he used to – in Marvel Comics, they used to have the Hempbeck strips and the letters pages and stuff. And that's where I know what he looked like. And I was like, man, this guy looks like him. What is his name? Oh, his name is Humpbeck. And I'm like, huh, I wonder if that's a Fred Hempbeck thingamajigger. But yeah, they introduced this guy. He's like a cool alien. He's just like a worker bee, like me and you. You know, you go to your job and he's like, man, you think being with the Rebel Alliance, I get to do cool shit, but they have me clean this and do this. And he's just complaining left and right. And poor guy gets killed immediately by these. They look like these floating electrical. Do you remember in Empire Strikes Back where they land inside that asteroid and those creatures are like attaching themselves to the Millennium Falcon and sucking the energy? Yeah. I don't remember what those creatures were, but that's what they look like in this comic book. They're like hitting all the electrical devices on the ship and actually destroying it. And that, so the ship that it went to go rescue these people is actually in worse shape because these creatures are just attacking all the electrical equipment. Plus these two bounty hunters were contracted by the Citadel to capture Callista. So what we learned out is the explosion that actually happened on the world of Euphorix was a fake presentation explosion to draw Callista out so they can capture Callista and find a way to break the shield. So that was kind of like a cool plot thread, you know. They let her away and she was convinced that it was real because she's like, there's no way the Citadel would know these like details. But the Citadel has like these brain creatures, which are like in Starship Troopers, they had these brain bugs. They have like these brain creatures that they can attach to people that they capture and they can just strip their information out of their head. And that's how they knew all the details about Euphorix. And the bug does, it assimilates the person. In other words, it starts sucking their brain knowledge out and it starts to look like them. So that's how the series ends, the issue ends, is it sucks her information out and it's starting to become her. And now Primus is going after to rescue her. But Lobo is kind of like just a small character. Like he's like a straight, he's like not the Lobo that we know. He's just like a straightforward bounty hunter on a space motorcycle, and he's with another bounty hunter, and they basically turn in Callista to the Citadel, and then they strip her of her memories, and it looks like they strip her of her life too. So it'll be interesting to hear what happens after that.
Yeah, I don't know much about the Omega Man.
Either do I. So I am learning them. I've learned a lot about the Omega Men through this series called Rebels by Tony Bedard. And that's where I was like, man, they're fascinating. I got to find out more about them. And I bought the full run.
Yeah, the only ones I have read, there's a couple issues that cross over with the New Teen Titans where they...
That's created by Wolfman.
Yeah. Yeah, and so when he was writing both books, he had a crossover with the two of them. And I remember it deals with Starfire. So when the Titans are in space doing some stuff with Starfire's background, they end up involving the Omega Man. Because I don't know, I think it's her brother that is involved with the Omega Man, Starfire's brother.
Yeah, at this point, he's not, but he will
be. Yeah, later on, yeah.
Yeah.
So, those are the only ones I've read, but I'm looking forward to Tom King's book. I'm going to check that out, because I've found his writing to be good on Grayson, so I'm willing to check it out. So, I have one more. Let's see. I read a couple issues of Wonder Woman.
Oh, right. I almost read some Wonder Woman as my choice.
I read issues 311 and 312 from her first series. So this is a little bit before little bit before the end.
Did it have a Huntress backup?
Yeah.
Yeah,
these issues both have. So they're about, the Wonder Woman story is about 17 pages, and then there's a Huntress backup. But,
do you hear this?
That I hear, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
She must be pretty close.
I don't know what she's... Oh! She almost knocked some glasses over.
Yeah, I definitely heard that one.
She will not be denied. She wants to play.
Pay attention to me.
Yeah.
It's a Wednesday night. What are you doing podcasting? So this cover is Great Hera Gremlins and Wonder Woman's lasso. She's flying from her lasso attached to the tail of her invisible jet, but her invisible jet is swarming with these little gremlin dudes. And it really jumps right into the story where she's trying to call her robot plane to herself, and it's ignoring her, it's not responding to her mental commands, and it turns out it's being piloted by this little green gremlin dude, and it dive bombs this crowd. She tells everybody, get down. And yes, appropriately, this story is called Gremlins, and it's by Dan Mishkin and Don Heck, who were the team around this time. So she manages to get her lasso around the plane's tail before it takes off again. But this little green gremlin dude, ibbity hippity, that's, they keep saying that, he takes her lasso and undoes it. She's starting to, she tries getting the mental commands again. It doesn't work. But at that point, Steve Trevor comes through with a flight of planes from the Air Force and picks her up. And it doesn't start until this page. You don't really realize it at first, but when Trevor appears, it turns out that this issue and the next are actually narrated by him from his perspective. So it's kind of a little bit of a different change. So they head in the direction that they saw her plane go, and they discover this weird area where it's sort of a resting place for lost ships up in the clouds. And these little gremlin dudes are trying to dismantle her plane. Then they start swarming on Steve's jet and start pulling parts off of his jet. So they land on one of the clouds. It turns out parts of the clouds are solid, though not all of them, because at one point Steve starts to fall through and Diana has to save him with her lasso. But they go into this large ship that they think might have be a command area or something, and they find these really... as opposed to the gremlins, who are super small, they find these really tall-looking, they're almost kind of Kirby-esque-looking guys, because they're, at least in their clothing and stuff, has a lot of different details to them that look like Kirby designs. They're really tall, like probably 12 or 13 feet tall, but they're really moving super slowly. Diana tries to talk to them, so they are alive, because when she tries to talk to them, the one shouts, "Intruders, lay down your weapons and surrender." And from nearby, the gremlins are laughing at them. So Wonder Woman and Steve, they they rather than surrender, because they're Diana's trying to take the peaceful route, but when she's not able, when there's this strange device that comes towards them, so she goes on the offensive and has to protect Steve from a couple of laser blasts. So they retreat outside to try to regroup, and then there's like this there's a little bit of a subplot with a general, what's his name? General Darnell, and some stuff happening on in Washington, D.C. Then it goes back to Steve and Diana, and they're in this sort of junkyard area where there's all this machinery that the gremlins have been pulling off from the various ships and stuff. And at the end, it's Diana's about to tell Steve her secret identity, but she's interrupted when the scrap heap that they're on starts to move sideways and everything starts to shift, and so they have to roll with it and try not to get hurt. But as the story ends, it's they're being shifted into this incinerator area, and the Huntress backup, which is called Crocodile Tears by Joey Cavalieri, Jim Burgard, and Mike DiCarlo. It starts off with her in a sewer, and she's ha ends up having to fight these crocodiles. But she's trying to track down this guy named Earthworm, so she finds this henchman of his. That's why she's in the sewer, I guess, is to try to get intel from him, of where this Earthworm guy is at. And the last couple pages are a politician, a guy named Marsh, that has a rally coming up, and he's watching his own appearance on television when the doorbell rings and he goes out, and there's a little baby wrapped in a blanket on his doorstep. And then as he's taking it in, we see this guy that I assumed at the time was Earth, when I read this, was this Earthworm, because he's halfway out of a sewer manhole, and his skin's all yellowish, and he's bald and kind of weird looking. Looks kind of like a worm, so. So it was pretty good issue. I mean, I like the art. It was kind of a middle of the road sort of average story. Good, not great. So 312 continues and kind of concludes the story.
It's interesting how the gremlins in the first issue all seem to have this little yellow piece of hair on the top. And then you get to the next issue and it seems random, like they're bald, some have hair, some have different color hair.
Yeah, I mean, there's a detail that got lost in between issues. But 312 is called Escape. It's the same creative team. So Steve and Diana have to fight their way out of this impending death at the incinerator stuff. Diana uses her. Or she gives her crown to Steve, and he throws it and breaks the power source. And when they get out, the gremlins are. They come across a bunch of gremlins disassembling an old Russian spaceship. So he goes after most of them. Steve wants to grab one of them. Most of them get away, but he does catch one of them. And this one, it turns out, is the one that was responsible for taking Diana's ship. And starts talking super fast, and it's really nervous, and Steve's holding it. Looks like he's holding a little doll. But the giants come back, and Diana has to take out the giant. But the gremlin that they've got explains to them, because the big alien that she took down, once it's out, they realize it doesn't even really seem to be alive. And the gremlin explains that the giant is real, but he's been without life support for several decades. And he said they're kind of similar to what you might call a scarecrow. And he says him and the other gremlins are the ones that keep the giant's ships in top condition. And he calls them I don't even know how you would say this out loud, your Turflerks. Y-T-I-R-F.
Turflerks. Turflerks.
Have you heard of them, or are you just making an attempt?
Making an attempt.
Your Turflerks. Yeah, it's... But,
I have read these issues. I just vaguely remember.
Yeah. I thought you might have. So the gremlins put back the stuff together, but their masters, the giants, were really bad, and so the gremlins would escape whenever they could. And about 75 years ago, they were near Earth, and they stole the mothership. But even though the gremlins are really good mechanics, they're really bad drivers, and they crash landed the mastership into Siberia. So they're gathering up all these old aircraft parts, trying to repair the ship that they broke. So then there's another bit of a subplot bit in Washington, D.C. So this is kind of like that other thing we were talking about today about older comics, is that they bring in subplots as you're going along, about a Major Griggs and on an island. And this sort of ties into what the next story is going to be, because we see that Circe is involved in what's going on this island. And I know I could see that the next story is involving Circe. But back to the main story, they show, they convince this one gremlin that they've got to take him to where they've got her robot plane, even though they've detached the tail fin from it already. So they're carrying around the tail. Diane's carrying around the tail fin, and she goes back to her plane, tells her plane to listen, to take orders from Steve. And then she runs out, and she attracts the attention of all the other gremlins, the ones that haven't been working on them, and then jumps out of the ship trying to get them to follow her. And meanwhile, so they start following her on these little flying jet things that they have. They're kind of like the thing that Captain America used to fly around on. So she's leading them around, and Steve and the gremlin, they're working together to get her ship going, and they have to take off in her robot plane before the gremlin's got the tail completely secured. So Steve's flying the plane, And he's like, you got to hurry up because we're heading towards the ground. And it's at the last second the gremlin gets it fully connected, and he's able to swoop back up before hitting the ground. And now they got this gremlin with them who's been detached from all their other all the other gremlins, and they feel like they're probably responsible for him now at this point. He's like, well, I was going to tell you my secret identity. And he says, whoa, 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 stop. I don't want to know. I don't want you to tell me your secret. You're my angel, and that's what I want you to stay, not to turn out to be someone who sweeps up at the Pentagon at night. And I just like, I don't, that just sounds kind of funny. Like, he's like, I don't want you to turn out to be ordinary. But the last page is a bit more about Cersei in the next story, where she breaks into a room in Themyscira, and she pulls out memory tapes of Princess Diana.
Nice. That sounds like a good issue.
Yeah, yeah.
I always like the Cersei issues.
So, very quickly, just the Huntress backup is called The Voice of the People. It's Joe Cavalieri again, and art by Dan Spiegel. And this continuing from the last time, that politician, Perry Marsh, it turns out that baby that was left on his doorstep, it was left there by Earthworm, as I thought, but the politician wasn't as surprised as it seemed like he might be, because he's actually working with Earthworm, and Earthworm did it to teach him a lesson that if he doesn't get rid of Huntress, he's going to expose him. They have some kind of racket going where they're providing abandoned infants to clients. So he had just taken one of the infants that they had for clients and used it to drop it on his door. And then the last few pages are this whole rally that Terry Marsh is planning on having. It's against vigilantes. So this news reporter sees that's there, that's getting ready to cover it. She spots Huntress watching on a roof, so she draws attention to her. And Huntress, you know, doesn't want to do a TV interview. So she jumps to another building, but a whole bunch of people that are there at the rally, a whole bunch of normal people, start climbing up the fire escape after her because, you know, they're obviously there because they're part of this whole, they're supporting this whole anti-vigilante thing. So she tries to get away, but by jumping out of the rooftops, which she, there's just so many people that she can't get away from all of them. And this installment ends with her surrounded by a ton of men with like wrenches and bottles and pieces of wood and stuff. So Huntress is in a little bit of a fix.
Yeah. Which one did you like better, the Wonder Woman or the Huntress?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit hard to compare just because
the size, 8 pages, yeah, versus 20.
Yeah, but I mean, the Wonder Woman, I like comics this era, so I like the style of it in terms of the style of art and the style of storytelling.
Yeah.
But the story, the plot itself was kind of goofy. I mean, I didn't hate it. It was probably like a 3 out of 5 for me, the two issues. So they were entertaining. I wasn't bored reading them or anything.
But did you do this on Comixology again?
These ones were too, yeah, because they had a sale. These were the first two. I bought like 19 issues of Wonder Woman for $1 each, and it goes from these issues all the way to the end of the series. And part of the reason I got these on Comixology was because not so much the ones that I just read, but especially as you get closer to the end of the series, they're really hard to find.
Uh-huh.
especially that very last issue of the series and stuff. So I just, it's like, rather than, I haven't gone all digital, but like I'm starting to mix in some, like when they do the sales, I haven't been buying them full price or anything, but when they do these sales for a dollar, I've been picking up some stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Well, my last one is, it's an odd one because it's like part seven of a 12-issue series or something like that. But it was one issue that I was missing is Deathstroke the Terminator number 33.
Oh, cool.
It's called Deathstroke's World Tour, and this is chapter 7, written by Marv Wolfman and art by Steve Irwin. And this was really, really, really good. I dug it. It makes me want to go read everything from the beginning.
Mm.
But on the cover, it has Deathstroke with the female vigilante, which had her own series at the time, too. And it opens up in, I believe it's Hong Kong. And the interesting thing about this that makes me want to read more is Deathstroke is trying to find 80. And apparently she's been kidnapped, but she looks like she's part of the kidnapping, like she staged it on herself. And he's basically chasing his wife around all these different places. That's why they call it World Tour. And he ends up at this ivory tower. And it's a really weird ivory tower. He traces her down to here. And he knows he needs to go to the top floor to go after whoever he – it's Kane's office. And he needs to find Kane in order to find out where his wife is or his ex-wife. And the other thing I learned is that 80 had a first husband, so Deathstroke was the second one. And I never knew that.
Yeah, I don't think I did either.
Yebut he presses the button to go to floor 45, which is the very – no, floor 60, excuse me. And it stops on floor 45, and he gets out. And this is a building. This is like a World Trade Center-type building. It's huge. And it's in, I believe it's in Hong Kong now. And he gets off on floor 45, and there's a running subway that looks like it's in New York inside this building in Hong Kong. And he's on the middle of the tracks. A subway just coming at him full speed and getting ready to run him over, and he manages to get away. And at this time, he's got that, like, pole. You know, Deathstroke has that pole. And he can, like, shoot, like, blasts out of that pole. He, like, carries with it. It's like a javelin. But at the end of the pole, he could shoot, like, concussive blasts or, like, it looks like a laser blast out of it. And he manages he can't stop this train with this blaster. And the only thing he could do to get away is shoot the ceiling and then climb up through the top of the ceiling. And that's where he ends up on a different floor, and he meets the female vigilante. And she says she's been trapped there for months as she was going after triads and weapons. And they kind of led her to this building. And she's been trapped here. And she says this is kind of like a building of hell. It's like has different floors, and you can never get out. Like, we're in hell right now. And they're using vigilante to like train the triads as a villain. Like she's just a pawn, and they're using her to, as long as she can survive, she's training the enemy. And it's such a weird building because every floor is like insane. Like, and then they have a whole gunfight with a bunch of triads, and that gunfight almost gets them killed, but they manage to escape to another floor level. And then they finally realize that they could probably get out if they blast this hole into the elevator shaft on the side, because they can't do it on the walls. The walls are just impenetrable. And so they go up the elevator shaft and actually go to the top floor. And meanwhile, Wintergreen is doing stuff for getting blueprints and stuff for Deathstroke, trying to get him out of the building. And they end up on the roof, and the roof, like, turns into this huge, like, flamethrower, and it looks like they're going to die because they can't leave the roof now. And they have to manage to, like, swing and blast their way into another floor. And when they get into that floor, they finally meet the guy that they're after, and he's stone cold dead. And the whole building's set to explode, and they have, like, a few seconds to get out of the building. And that's kind of how it ends. It ends that he finds out that his wife is there and holding Wintergreen hostage. Like, his wife might be against him at this point, and you don't know exactly why or how. And this is his wife that he had Jericho with, and, you know, Ravager. And so it's a really interesting plot thread as she throws Wintergreen. She doesn't kill him, but she throws him away, and she says to stay away from her, and then she takes off again, and then Deathstroke is going to go back after her again. And it's continuing the world tour. Really interesting ad in here, and I thought I would read it. Some of the ads, they have an advertisement for Batman in the Darkest Night. It's an Elseworlds story, like if he has the ring. And they have a series. I used to love, like, Simon and Kirby's Fighting American, and I followed him around in a couple of incarnations, including Liefeld's Fighting American. But there was a DC one, and I need to seek that out. But there's an ad in here about AIDS. It's just so bizarre. And it has Booster Gold and Blue Beetle. And it says, "You may think it's not your problem." That's how the comic starts. And Beetle is talking to Booster, and he goes, "You know, Booster, I envy you. I tell you, I'm afraid to even date these days." And Booster says, "You mean AIDS? Don't worry, I only date nice women." And then Fire comes in the room, and she says, "You morons! Do you think you can only get AIDS from people who aren't nice? It doesn't matter who you are. The HIV virus doesn't discriminate. Many of my friends back home have died of AIDS. It doesn't mean that they weren't nice, or that it was some kind of punishment. Everyone is at risk of exposure to HIV, the virus that can lead to AIDS." And she says, "Listen, I don't need to attend any more funerals. If you're going to be intimate, protect yourself. Know the facts, at least for me." That's what Fire says. And then Booster says, "I feel a little better, but she sure knows how to take the fun out of things." And Booster says, "Maybe we should be thinking about, more than fun right now." In other words, take it seriously.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. And then it gives you like 800 numbers to call for facts of AIDS. This is probably during the AIDS outbreak, and that's why they had it in there. This is in 1994. That was a really interesting ad.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to post it on Facebook.
It was definitely a time where people were still had a lot of misconceptions.
Yeah.
That's interesting that they were using some DC characters to help.
Yeah, Fire laid on to them, man. Do you mean the AIDS attack, it doesn't hurt nice people? It doesn't discriminate. My friends are nice.
Like, you guys are morons.
Yeah. So I'm still missing three issues from Deathstroke. One of them's a really cool cover because it's issue 41. And it's got one of my favorite characters on the cover. It's got Deadshot and Bronze Tiger on there, kind of like holding Deathstroke, which is really cool because he's got like – it looks like Deathstroke just blasted the shit out of him right in the heart. But I really want to get that one. And then the next one I'm missing is issue 58. And I hear this one – I've seen Aaron Myers post about this one, saying that it was rare, and it's got Joker on the cover. That's probably why.
Hmm.
And it's actually, in my database, which is conservative, listed as $13, which is pretty high for a Deathstroke.
Yeah.
And then I'm missing annual number 4, and then I am done. I have gotten a full run of Deathstroke. So, yeah, that was a fun issue. All of these issues I liked. I really enjoyed all of them. They made me want to read the next issue, except the Justice Writers, which didn't have a next issue, but I would have read it if they had a next issue. Because I wanted to see what happened to Wally, because a guy is still after him at the end.
Yeah, maybe they put that in there in case there was a sequel or something.
Yeah. But I'm glad you could do this episode. Oh, we have a few questions. You have time for a few?
Yeah, I did look at them.
Okay.
And I have an answer ready for them, so it shouldn't take too long.
Let's see.
Daryl will be happy because I chatted with him briefly before we started recording, and he said that he needed us to do at least 2 hours.
Yeah, Daryl's mad at me because I took time off.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. I mean, family, I didn't want to break away for 2-3 hours. And.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Donnie says, what's your favorite era of Teen Titans and which is your favorite lineup of Teen Titans?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could be more original.
Against the grain?
Yeah, but I can't. I mean, if I'm going to be honest, my favorite is the initial lineup of the new Teen Titans, Wolfman and Perez, with Kid Flash on the team, of course. And that's my favorite era too. And then when he started to. Not just because Kid Flash was on the team, but yeah, that's my favorite era, and my favorite team was that initial lineup. I guess you could say my favorite era kind of extends beyond when, because Kid Flash took time off from the team when Terra came in, and then Wally didn't really come back when everything happened with Terra, and that's when they brought Jericho in, and he took time off and then ended up becoming the Flash. So, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to say the same era is my favorite, but I want to give shouts out to the first series, which is when the things were 12 cents by Bob Haney and Nick Carty. I enjoyed that quite a bit. And I almost have a full run of that. I'm missing like 5 or 6 issues. And then,
I've been covering all of those from Kid to Flash. Yeah.
And then we get Teen Titans Volume 2, because the volume that is our favorite is called the New Teen Titans specifically. Right. But yeah. Teen Titans Volume 2, I am one of the very few that really enjoyed this series. This is the one with Johto, Risk, Argent, Prism. And Ray Palmer, as he was DH'd during Zero Hour, I was a fan of this, and I think it's because I'm a fan of Dan Jurgens, and I love the way he draws, and I love the way he writes, and this series really worked for me, so that was a good series. And then I want to give another shout out to Teen Titans Volume 3. Which was Jeff Johns and Mike McCone, which there was some really, really fantastic stuff that happened in this Jeff Johns run. And the other part that I really enjoyed was the Sean McKeever issues, which was later in the run. I know a lot of people didn't like that too much, but that's where you had like Miss Martian and the female Captain Atom and Spoiler and... You had Speedy. You had a lot of good characters, and I really dug Sean McKeever's run. And then a lot of the art was done by Eddie Burrows, and I really, really enjoyed his stuff. And that's where you had the weird Wonder, the Marvin and the Wonder Dog, and that he turned into a weird character. There's some weird shit that happened in it, but man, now I enjoyed those issues, and I read the shit out of them like as soon as I got them. Really good series, and then it had Kid Devil from Blue Devil in there that I really enjoyed. So that lineup, and then they had Blue Beetle and Ravager. That was like a really good lineup for me. So I enjoyed all four volumes. The new volume, I'm kind of hit or miss. I enjoy some issues, and I haven't felt it like the other Titans that there were like a unit or But I'm still reading it and I'm still enjoying it. So yeah, I enjoy the Titans, but I've always enjoyed them, even when they were called the Titans. They're the deluxe format. Let's see, what was the next question? I think I just lost it. Oh, there's from Glenn Clark. If you could create one super team, picking anyone from any company, not just the big two, who would make the cut on an 8-person roster?
I totally, on this question, I totally didn't take advantage of the fact that I could use characters from any company.
Yeah.
Because I think just because of Convergence, I'm really thinking about DC a lot right now, and I just decided to create an interesting Justice League lineup from just any kind of era. And so, I mean, these aren't my 8 favorite characters, although some of them are. But I thought this might be an interesting team. So I have, let's see, I'll get the obvious one out of the way first. I do have, of course, the post-crisis Wally West Flash on the team. I can't leave him out. But then I have post-crisis John Stewart for my Green Lantern. And I have also the post-crisis Dr. Midnight, the Peter Cross Dr. Midnight. He is a favorite too. And then I also did pre-crisis Mary Marvel. I was gonna have Captain Marvel, but then I changed it up.
To get a female in there.
Add another one. I do have actually a lot of females, so I thought I'd be modern in that respect. I got pre-crisis Earth One Wonder Woman, maybe because I was just reading those issues. And then I have, you just mentioned her, instead of Martian Manhunter, I have Magan, Miss Martian. So I always thought she was cool.
She is. Sean McKeever run there. I like that.
Yeah. Probably the newest character as far as the very first version of that character. Because then, because I wanted to pull characters from different origins or different eras too, I have a couple of new 52 versions of characters for the last two. I have the new 52 Mira and the new 52 Zatanna.
Nice.
So that's my 8 person Justice League from various eras of DC with a lot of women.
Yeah. And you know, when I look at this question, I don't want to ever mix my companies. Like I wouldn't want to take Spider-Man and put him with Superman. I don't like that. Like, I don't want my Valiant with my Image, and I don't know why. I want them to be separate. And
yeah, I wonder if
I'm gonna have a lame answer. I'm gonna go with the Outsiders, Batman and the Outsiders, and it's an 8-person lineup. So I'm already almost taken because I'm gonna go with Batman. I'm gonna go with Metamorpho. I'm gonna go with Katana. I'm gonna go with Geoforce. I'm gonna go with what am I missing? Halo. Black Lightning. So that's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I can only do two more. I'm gonna go with the modern outsiders because I liked them so much. Grace and Thunder, which was Black Lightning's daughter. That would be a good father-daughter combination. So that would be my outsiders. That's and cool. The only reason I picked Grace and Thunder is because I think it'd be I liked them when they were in the outsiders. And but man, if I could extend the roster, I would love to have the Looker in there because she's another one that I like a lot. Mm. And Dick Grayson and Arsenal. But I only have 8, so that's the one I'm going to go with. The original Outsiders plus Grace and Thunder, who are in Volume 3. And then in Volume 2, you had a weird lineup. You had, like, the Eradicator and, God, I can't even remember some of these people. One of the Faust kids and Felix Faust's son. I can't remember his name. Technocrat, which was on armor, and a monster-looking guy called Wildy, and Katana was still in it, and then Looker, who looked a little different. She was the vampire version.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, I love the Outsiders. I don't know why. They're kind of like the Defenders, but they're more functional. And they worked well together. Like, they were characters that, I don't know, like, were B-list characters, but as a team, they were, like, A-list to me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, thank you for the questions, cool. Donnie and Glenn Clark. So yes. I will get this episode out probably tomorrow night and then go to Denver Comic Con. But thank you for recording this. I'm glad we could get one in.
Yeah. I think
that we would have lost another week.
Yeah. Yeah, it worked out good. And
it works out good for me. It works out worse for you because it's already 10:30.
That's okay. I'm ready for bed, so I can just go to sleep. Yeah. I'm already ready. All right. I was just hoping I didn't fall asleep.
You at least made Daryl happy, so.
Yes, this episode is dedicated to Daryl.
There we go. And you can reach us on Twitters at MythMakingETC, at Mike Myers Brunch. Our webpage is geekbrunchpodcast.com. You could go to Facebook and search for Geek Brunch Podcast with spaces in between the words and click the like button and follow all our threads there. You also post your Mythmaking ETC episodes there from Kid to Flash. And the latest thing you did was like a hashtag Conway crossover, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard that a bunch of podcasts were doing a crossover to focus on Jerry Conway and kind of was motivated out of this post that he had made.
The controversy things?
Yeah, so it doesn't...
I heard they made peace.
Yeah, yeah. So it doesn't really get into that. It's very positive. It's not, you know, it's not an anti thing. It's just...
to recognize a great creator.
Yeah, at least that's definitely my approach and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's a Kid to Flash episode because I had a couple issues of Secret Society of Supervillains coming up later on, and I just kind of moved them up because there wasn't really much continuity issues with doing that. So, but yeah, it was cool to be a part of it. There's a lot of different my show notes for that episode. I have links to all the other shows that are involved in it and stuff. It's pretty cool to be a part of it.
Very cool. I would have done something if I would have known about it in time. But No, I wouldn't have. I don't have any time. I can't even get my own.
Time.
Can't even get my own podcast out.
Yeah.
I got to get them back on track.
It's sometimes you need to take a break, and you know, you do a lot of podcasting, so.
There is a DC Noise coming out. I'm not in it, but it should be fun because Savage Chuck and I think John Thurman showed up for a little bit. But you got that coming up. And then there's an unrecorded Valiant podcast that me and Chris did that he forgot that we had. I didn't forget, but he did. And so that should be coming out soon. So even though I haven't been recording, There'll be some stuff out there.
Yeah.
I got to get Valiant Versus done this month, so I at least keep my monthly schedule. But thank you for recording, and you sleep good, my friend.
All right.
Good day at work tomorrow.
Oh, let me see. I got to check something real quick before I let you go. Let's see here. All right, yeah, tell your wife I said go Phillies.
Chris says go Phillies. No. She said no.
They're playing the Rockies right now as we speak.
Yeah.
I had to check to see if the Phillies were winning before I said that.
Ah.
So, all right.
Yeah, we're rooting against them because that's MBAT's team too. So.
Oh, I didn't know that. I know you. He has a rivalry with your wife.
Yeah.
Over everything.
Yeah.
Pretty much, it looks like, from Twitter or from Facebook.
From Facebook, yep.
Yeah.
So, all right, my friend. Go Rockies. Have a good one, and we'll talk to you maybe not this weekend, but the weekend after.
As far as I know, it should be good.
Okay. Have a good one. See
you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.